it's detachable. This comes in handy a lot of the time. I can leave it home when I think it's going to get me in trouble. Or I can rent it out when I don't need it. But now and then I go to a party, get drunk, and the next morning I can't, for the life of me, remember what I did with it. First I looked around my apartment and I couldn't find it. So I called up the place where the party was. They hadn't seen it either. I asked them to check the medicine cabinet, because for some reason I leave it there sometimes, but not this time. So I told them if it pops up to let me know. I called a few people who were at the party, but they were no help either. I was starting to get desperate. I really don't like being without my penis for too long. It makes me feel like less of a man, and I really hate having to sit down every time I say the leak. After a few hours of searching the house, calling everyone I could think of, I was starting to get very depressed, so I went to the Kia and ate breakfast. Then as I walked down 2nd Avenue towards St. Mark's Place, where all those people sell used books and other junk on the street, I saw my penis lying on a blanket next to a broken toaster oven. Some guy was selling it. I had to buy it off him. He wanted $22, but I talked him down to $17. I took it home, washed it off, and put it back on. I was happy again. Complete. People sometimes tell me I should get it permanently attached, but I don't know. Even though sometimes it's a pain in the ass, I like having a detachable penis.
Somebody's watching me.
I know that song.
Well, why are you coming out of my computer speakers? What the hell's going on here?
I don't know. It's because I'm home activated.
I can hear you everywhere. Your voice surrounds me.
That's awesome.
What the hell's going on?
Do you want me to try to call you back? You probably have to have your settings set to, you know, plug in your device again so it triggers.
Okay. Well, you can hear me?
I can hear you fine, but you sound like you're coming out of your computer speaker.
All right. Let me redo this.
All right. You want me to call you back? Or do you want to just unplug it and try to plug it back in?
Yeah, let's see what happens. I'll unplug. I'll pull out.
Pull out. Pull out.
Okay.
No. Same thing.
Still feels the same. All right. Better call me back.
But in your if you look at your Skype, and one of them is let's see, tools, options.
Audio
settings. If you look at those drop downs for speakers and microphone, they're probably something else.
How's this sound?
That's better.
Yeah, that's okay. You don't have to call me back.
Yeah, how about that?
I can leave it in. I just had to adjust my position.
Yeah, you just have to adjust your position. You can pull out a little bit.
Yeah.
Just in too deep.
Move it around. Wiggle it.
Yeah, I'm not going to edit any of that shit out.
No, that was gold. That was podcasting gold.
People will learn from that.
This is tech tips.
Yeah, tech tips. They're retro tech tips because we're using old Skype.
Because it's shit that people should already know if they're a podcaster like me. Do you like my new picture?
Yeah, it's a bear and two tigers.
That's my photo of DC Noise. That makes me think of you guys, three big animals.
Three
that
big animals like to cuddle. Something.
They like to cuddle and eat. together.
Yeah. That's us. So how are you doing? Are you got a lot of snow?
Yeah, it's been accumulating and not melting, so we have a lot just over time, although nothing really compares to that storm that we had back in November.
Yeah.
But it's what's really gotten to us lately is just the cold. I mean, it's been wind chills. Like yesterday was a little warmer, but beginning of last week and the end of last week, we had wind chills that were negative 20, negative 20 through negative 30 below.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be, there's another wind chill warning tonight through tomorrow. And it's just getting to us.
Gets old after a while.
It does. But I don't know. Hopefully this week is not going to be too warm, but I don't know. It's the last week of February, so hopefully March will start to transition out of the bitter cold. But yeah, just been bundling up.
Yeah, we got hit yesterday and today, but we're getting nothing like out east. Usually we're the ones complaining, but it's been a fairly mild winter until now.
The thing that always seems crazy to me about your weather is how much it can fluctuate.
Yeah.
Most of the time our weather goes in gradations. If it's going to warm up, it warms up over time and on like a smooth gradient kind of. And I'll see you guys post about reading comics on the deck in 60 degree weather, and then the next thing... I feel like a few days later, I see you talking about how it's too cold to walk Harley.
Yeah, yeah.
It's crazy.
Changes every week.
Yeah.
It seems like every week we have like 3 good days and 4 bad days or vice versa.
That's due to the mountains and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Except we're out east. We're kind of far from the mountains. They get a lot more snow. But we get the winds. So, like, if we got a wind chill of 30, the roads are worse over here because there's nothing blocking them.
Mm-hmm.
The ice over.
Gotcha. Yep.
Alrighty.
As long as we don't have to deal with Papa Smurfs, then you're doing all right. Okay. You're a little too good at that. That was kind of frightening. I got some you gave me some flashbacks. That was a little
scary. I enjoyed that episode, believe it or not.
Did you?
I thought when you posted the picture on the site, I was like, man, that looks goofy. But I kind of enjoyed the episode. I thought it was pretty. It reminded me of like a Star Trek episode. Visiting the Hills Have Eyes. it's bizarre. It's so different. It's not killing me. Like I don't hate it. I don't sit down and say, God, I hate this show.
No.
Twiggy is totally out of the show. He's not even a player anymore.
Yeah, he had a couple lines, but it doesn't.
But he's like. They give it mostly to the other guy, the other robot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a shame.
That's an asshole robot. I work with somebody like that. It really, all the responses Crichton. And replies are just like Crichton.
Oh, man.
It's like no emotion, nothing. It's just like Crichton. It's like saying it to a machine.
That's... That's one of the stereotypes of people that work in computers.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of. It's interesting when people embody stereotypes.
Real machine, though. There's like no human emotion.
Crazy. Ultron.
Yeah. You can't even get a reaction out of him. He's like... It's like Crichton.
Yeah, it's not excruciating to watch, but it is interesting how different it is. And did Barb watch it with you?
Yeah, she watched it. She doesn't like this season too much.
Yeah.
She pokes fun of it the whole time.
Yeah, she seemed...
And I just think... tell her, shut up! It's just serious research I'm doing here.
You need... You're my wife. You're supposed to support me.
You're supposed to support me and love everything I do. Why do you have to go on hate on this?
That's okay. My wife doesn't even watch them with me. She just shakes her head if she happens to walk in the room. At least before she was shaking her head at the outfits the women were wearing now, that's nowhere to be seen either, really.
Yeah, it's weird. They're like all like wearing like submarine navy uniforms on the bridge and
they don't have the money.
Yeah.
They don't have the money to hire Playboy Playmates anymore to come on the show.
But, it was a long episode, though. It was two back-to-back two-parters.
Yeah. Yeah, it was another two-parter.
And this one's a lot of, like, walking.
Yes.
It's like a Lord of the Rings. Like, Keith would love this movie.
Yeah. There's even a Hobbit. Sort of.
A Hobbit, yeah.
Yeah, it was called Journey to Oasis, and it aired on January 22nd of 1981. There is a interesting guest star in the episode, though, even if he's not a sexy young lady. There's a character called Ambassador DeVoe, who's very important to the episode. And
very important to another sci-fi.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I was going to say. He's the actor is Mark Lenard, and listeners might know him from Star Trek franchise. I guess he particularly is known as the father of Spock, right?
Yeah.
That would be his main. I mean, he did a couple other little appearances, I guess. He was the first Romulan you ever see in the original series, in Balance of Terror, and a couple other things. But
I think the Romulans and the Klingon, I mean, the Vulcans look so similar. Well, they're kind of like derived, right, from each other or something like that.
Yeah, I'm not the best.
But it's the eyebrows. It's the eyebrows. Like, you know what gave him away is you're like, God, I know that guy. It's the eyebrows. It's the Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't need any makeup to be a Vulcan or a Romulan.
No, I mean, you look at the guy, if you were a casting director, you look at the guy's photo and say, oh yeah, we definitely could use this guy for a Romulan or a Vulcan.
Yeah.
But yeah, he played Fox's father as Sarek in a whole bunch of stuff. The original series and voiced it in the animated series, and then in Search for Spock, Voyage Home, and Undiscovered Country. He even appeared as the elderly version of the character in a couple Next Generation episodes.
That's one of my favorites, Undiscovered Country. I love that one. That's the killing of the ambassador Klingon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I love that. That's my second favorite Star Trek. Score. Like, I buy a lot of the Star Trek, you know, like motion picture musical scores.
Mm-hmm.
And the music for Undiscovered Country is pretty good. I really like it.
Star Trek is probably, I'll probably get shamed for this, but Star Trek is a huge blank area in my... geekdom.
By choice, or is it by just
not really
not seeking it out, or not
by active choice, like not by purposely avoiding it or disliking it. I mean, I guess if I was really drawn into it naturally, but I mean, I grew up, I guess I watched some Next Generation episodes kind of regularly for a little while there after school, And I've gone back and watched maybe half of the original series, but and I really like the two reboot movies. I've seen both of those a couple times, but I haven't seen any of the other movies.
Well, you have more experience than me in The Next Generation, because that's the one I couldn't stand.
So and then
I like the original series. I like the movies, except for the when I saw the motion picture, it was like I was either too young and it was too close to Star Wars, or I was like, this is nonsense. I wanted to just leave. I love the movies. I love the original crew. And then I kind of like Deep Space Nine. But other than that, I don't usually venture into the property too deep.
Yeah, from what I hear about Deep Space Nine, I think I would like it. And I think I should just watch that instead of trying to watch everything that comes before it.
Mm-hmm.
Just jump in and check that out and whatever. But so yeah, I mean,
but this is very similar to Undiscovered Country in plot.
Oh yeah.
In Undiscovered Country, they need to get the ambassador of the Klingon over to a conference safely, and the ambassador's killed, and they blame the Federation for it, and they blame Captain Kirk is the main culprit for his death. Well, in this one, it's a little bit different. It's, this ambassador is coming for a peace negotiation. He has to be at a specific conference at a given time. And they hit this like electrical cloud is their, you know, their meeting. And then there's some weird setup there. There was something that really bothered me, and I knew what they were setting up, but they introduced the ambassador and their race. They look human, but they can detach their heads. It's like, who cares? I really like what is the benefit of that other than you can maybe be in two places at once doing something? Your body could be lifting something and your head could be watching it. I don't know. But he doesn't want to let he says that the human will not understand if they see that. And they play that out in the plot is, you know, they play out that he can remove his head. But they also say he's like talking to one of his, I guess his like servants that's helping him get ready for this conference. You know, he's getting this outfit on, which looks very reminiscent of like a Battlestar Galactica outfit, which probably is. They're probably sharing a prop or something. But he gets the outfit on and he's like, how do I look? He says, I'm going to see somebody that I used to care for a lot. And I was like, oh, that's going to be Wilma. And he's like, well, I used to see her when she was a little girl. And I'm like, this pedophile motherfucker. Like, what is he talking about? but I guess they met when she was like a lieutenant in flight school or something. And
yeah, I took him to mean like a young lady, like when she was maybe like 18, 19 or something.
The term that he used, though, was girl. When you're 18, I don't use that term.
Some people do, though.
I don't know. I think young.
Yeah.
18, you're out of, you know, high school and you're ready to become an adult. But anyway, he's had a relationship with her somewhat, and he looks like he could be your father, in my opinion.
Yeah. Which they do allude to that later on.
Yeah. But they get just to finish setting it up is they have to take him to this the conference, and they end up getting into an electrical storm, which I was always confused as like, was this something that little blue troll did? Or that's energy that fed the blue troll's power. But anyway, they end up in that electrical storm. It brings their shuttle down, and they lose all communications with both ships, the searcher and the ship that brought the ambassador. So then there's like this political intrigue aboard the searcher and the other ship, thinking that the Earth people did something malicious to steal their ambassador, and they're gonna like blackmail him. So you know that's the basic plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do. You remember that song, "Detachable Penis"?
No, was it in this episode and I missed it?
No, but it is by a band called King Missile. It was from the 90s, and the whole detachable head thing made me think of it. Which I thought was kind of funny. It's I'll have to share you the video or something, but it's about a guy who wakes up and finds out that his penis is missing, and so he goes on like an adventure to try to find his penis, and then he happens upon a one of those street vendors that sell stuff on the street, like jewelry and stuff, who has his penis, and he buys it back from the street vendor and takes it home and reattaches it.
We'll have to put that in the opening.
Yeah, sounds good. It's a different kind of detachable head.
Yeah.
But I thought, as strange as that role was in terms as far as having a detachable head and stuff, Mark Lenard, the actor, I thought he was one of the better parts of the episode.
I agree.
Yeah, I thought his acting was good. I think he sold that whole thing.
And he sold the role of an ambassador in whatever he was doing. And his, like, even his, what would you say, like, he would get into a lot of uncomfortable situations with Buck. Because he always thought as Buck, I never got the impression that Buck felt he was competition for this guy, but he thought Buck was his competition, you know? Because I think at this point in the series, Buck and Wilma are really friends. I mean, they've always been friends, but I don't feel like there's any, other than some of the things Wilma does, I don't think there's any kind of like, I need to score kind of a relationship.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's, I'm curious to see how it goes throughout the rest of the season, because I keep reading in things that people have written about this season that they tried to develop a little bit more of a romantic tension between the two. And I felt like there might have been some of that here, but I don't know if I'm just, if I'm seeing that because I've read that, or if I hadn't read it, if I would be picking up on it or not. But it's not, if anything, it's only the beginnings of it for Buck.
Seemed more like a brother-sister relationship, like I'm looking out for you kind of thing. At least from Buck's perspective. Wilma, it was too hard to tell because she was kind of with the ambassador the whole time. You know, walking with him. And then Dr. Goodfellow, oh my God, that guy's a trip.
Is he? He's kind of. I noticed he was starting to get on my nerves a bit this episode. He's kind of like the
starting?
Jar Jar Binks.
Starting.
He's kind of like the Jar Jar Binks of Buck Rogers. That character that just keeps bumbling along and getting into trouble, so the other characters have to save him. And
well, his whole role is annoying because he's like a scientist that's like in his 80s, like He can't go on these walking missions and shit like that. But he's so intrigued by new civilizations and stuff. Like, he wants to record them. He wants to learn from them. And that's his whole point of being. So what he ends up doing is, like, tricking the admiral on the ship of the searcher into thinking that he gave him permission. when he didn't give him permission to go on this. And then it's kind of like a disaster because they have – They send down Hawk, and Hawk is supposed to be taking care of Dr. Goodfellow to make sure he's doing okay. But Hawk also has another purpose, as Buck wants to keep his eye on Wilma and the ambassador. So he always sends Hawk on these missions, like, can you go after these people, or, you know, go find out who's laughing in the mountains, or, you know, do stuff like that. And every time he does that, then Goodfellow goes off on his own and he gets himself into trouble, and then they have to kind of rescue him. Although he did have a heroic moment in the episode where he did mm-hmm. something that was useful.
Yeah. The first thing that he wants to go off and investigate and is stopped from doing is that laughter that you were imitating. They hear it from a distance. They don't really know where it's coming from, and he wants to go check it out, but they want to keep moving. While Buck and the Admiral, Ambassador, Wilma, Birdman, or Hawk, rather, the Birdman.
He calls him Birdman, though, in all fairness. The little
troll.
Yeah,
that's true. That's probably what's in my head.
Smurf calls him Birdman. So.
Yeah. They're all on the planet traveling, you have the political intrigue going on between Lieutenant Asimov and the people and the ambassador's people. The first of which is the ambassador's people wants Asimov and another guy to meet them in an airlock as a neutral ground. And Asimov's pretty suspicious of the others. He does show himself to be a smart character, a smart leader, as he's thinking, you know, that this could go badly, they need a backup plan in case they're accused of trying to kidnap the ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought that there's these sort of, I guess, native creatures to the planet that they're on that really look like cheap Planet of the Apes people.
They look like Neanderthals, but they're kind of like Chaka from the Land of the Lost. If you watch Land of the Lost, there was the, you know, Chaka was the little kid caveman who had hair all over his body and a Neanderthal face. And that's what these things look like, except they were much larger. They were like Neanderthals with spears that worshipped a headless god, and they were always following these people, all, you know, the Buck Rogers and team, but they were also being followed by this blue troll. And he was a weird character, but I think he made the episode sort of interesting. And there was some really weird scenes with that character. And didn't they make a relationship? Didn't the Dr. Goodfellow say he was related to some exploratory Earth satellite that they launched into space way back in the day or something? I don't remember. But I thought that was interesting.
Mm, yeah, if they did, I didn't catch that. His name's ODX.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, actually, I think someone else does the voice, but the actor that is the body of the character, for lack of a better word, is Felix Silla, who's the same person that's inside the Twiggy costume.
Ah.
Actually. And he is bright blue. Like, just that's one of the things I thought like made him look kind of weird, is that his skin is bright blue, not just like a darker shade of it or something. And
that's like a Smurf.
Yeah, and he's got, I think it's because maybe the mask has larger circles around the eyes, and then they used paint underneath, face paint underneath around the eye or something, but it's a darker color, so it makes him look like he has really, really hollowed eyes, like he's a little blue Smurf heroin junkie or something.
It's like the latex that goes over the eyes. It's so big mm-hmm. that his real eye looks like it's has some depth to it.
Yeah, I think that's part of what makes him look sort of creepy.
Yeah, he almost looks like one of the, if you watch the movie, the horror movie, they've had a couple of them called Leprechaun.
Oh yeah.
He kind of looks like a blue leprechaun, and he even acts like one. Like he's just a mischievous dwarf that has mystical abilities in the that seem to be related to his eyes. Like he can move things, he can manipulate things, he can put people to sleep. He could do a lot of different things, and he's kind of like the guide in this episode. Like he's guiding Buck and them to this city, but he's not just he could outright help them, but he doesn't. He helps them through riddles, and he does some weird stuff like with Hawk. Like he almost becomes friends with Hawk, or Hawk becomes more friends with him, because Hawk was dead serious in the first episode, and in this episode you see Hawk smiling a lot with that character. Do you know what I mean? Did you notice how much times he like laughed, or he thought that character was like funny?
Yeah, you're right. He has a much lighter nature about him the whole time, and he's not a part of any sort of conflict with the group. I don't know if a lot of time is supposed to have passed or not, but he definitely seems to be have accepted his new station after the end of the last episode. He
Yeah.
doesn't seem, he's definitely just a part of the group now. And yeah, there are certainly a out of all the characters, I think he was the one that felt most at ease or most was the most amused by ODX.
Yeah, 'cause he never like was threatened by him. He was always like trying to capture him, but there's even one really weird scene where he's Buck sends a hawk into the mountains to try to find ODX or whoever's following them. And he goes over there and he does find him. This is the second time he finds him. And he almost tries to capture him, but then ODX puts him to sleep and he ends up sleeping with him. Like he literally sleep puts his head on Hawk's chest and falls asleep.
Yeah, that was
And
really weird.
they spend the night together.
In addition to shooting blue electricity out of his eyes, ODX also has a roofie power.
Yeah, he does. So
But yeah, that was weird. I thought he
they
was
give
going to
him
do something to
a
him.
sex pill. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to do something too, but he after watching the entire episode, it seems like he's extremely lonely. Like and he found like this bond with Hawk where he just wanted to be with somebody that night, 'cause it was getting night and he didn't want to sleep alone. Plus he was losing his powers. Like his powers would come and go based on those cl that cloud activity, it seemed like, you know? It's like he'd start fully charged and then he'd run out of powers. And he would give him weird clues. But before, when he first introduces himself, Dr. Goodfellow gets himself into a bind because he's trying to communicate with the people, and the people actually are speaking English. At least you think they are, but it's the blue guy that's actually talking back to Goodfellow and laughing. And he thinks that it's these caveman people, so he goes chasing them, and they essentially throw him into like a hole in the ground and put a rock over him. And then he's like, "Help! Help!" And then they have to rescue it. And they can't lift the rock.
It's huge.
So ODX comes and he uses his powers to lift the rock and save him. But Goodfellow, after this, if they don't learn from this and like say, "You stay the fuck on the ship, you're more a hindrance than help," then because all these missions are turning into disasters. He should be nowhere near an adventure. He can barely walk,
Right.
much less navigate a whole desert.
Yeah, and the whole time he's just muttering to himself, "Oh dear, oh dear,
He
oh
says
dear."
everything in twos. At least that's what Barb said. He was annoying Barb, and he says, "Why does he say everything twice?"
Yeah, that's a good call. I think that's probably true. He definitely mutters and to himself a lot. I mean, no disrespect to the actor. I think he had a really long career and everything like that. And I think that's he's playing the actor as he's supposed to be, but as he's not a not my favorite addition to this cast for sure.
I like some of the concept of what he does, like him being the guy that wants to like chart all of these civilizations. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I just don't like that he's on these expeditions.
Right. If they would have made him less of a bumbling professor and made him more of more similar to Dr. Hewer, or yeah, better yet, just kept Dr. Hewer on the ship. But even if they couldn't keep the actor, just have him on there on the ship and have give them some way of communicating with him, and just have him be the character that gives the exposition, you know, that they can radio back and, you know, look at this picture of this thing that we found. Can you give us some information about it? And he can drop the knowledge and they can go on, you know?
Yeah.
But, there was a funny moment. This is sort of a funny line delivery by ODX where Hawk or somebody calls him Little One, and at the same time as asking him how long he's been on the planet. And he says, I detest that term, Little One. About 400 years. And the way that he sort of went from one line to another sounded sort of funny. But
I liked his character. I think that's him and the ambassador is what made the episode sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could done with a little bit of a different look for him.
It did look wise and goofy. Stuff. It did look goofy, but
yeah, but no, not a terrible. I mean, he's definitely like a imp character, like a trickster, like a Mixpickalick or
yeah,
a Gazoo or a Batmite.
Yeah.
But not a bad character.
And the Flintstones. I haven't heard that reference in a long time.
I think that was the first one I probably saw, really. I mean, and then when I saw Mixpickalick, that made me think of Gazoo.
Yeah.
I mean, because Flintstones were still in syndication when I was a kid, and my dad liked Flintstones from when he was a kid, so he, you know, sometimes he would sit down and watch it, and I would watch it with them. So,
yeah,
Flintstones and the Jetsons. But, so yeah, then there's a point at which Buck finds out before Wilma does, and it's significant that he does, that he finds out that the ambassador and his race of people can remove their heads. And I thought it was funny, the exchange that they had, because basically the ambassador says, turns it around on Buck and says, you know, essentially, maybe you're the weird one because you can't remove your head. one evening at one of their campsites, Buck and Wilma have a emotional exchange where Buck is anticipating that Wilma doesn't realize that he isn't just like a human and that he has this ability and that it might bother her, and he sort of seems to be looking out for her and wanting to protect her, but she thinks that he's just either being jealous or meddling in her affairs where he shouldn't. And she gets upset with him.
He does keep the secret, though. He doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
In all fairness, he could easily have. He has no loyalty to the ambassador. He could say, no. Yeah, I saw him take off his head. That's cool. Do you know he can take off his head? All he tries to tell her is, do you know everything you think you know about this ambassador?
Yeah.
And then she takes it really offensively, like, oh, you're just jealous because I'm with him and I'm holding his arm. And
right. Yeah, and he has no real reason to be loyal to the ambassador because the ambassador's just been standoffish and a little bit of a jerk, because the ambassador definitely seems to see Buck as competition. But
there's one scene where there's these weird algae looking creatures that are on these rocks. And that's what leads him to take off his head. I guess they loosened it a little bit or something. Because it wraps its tendril or whatever around her Wilma's neck and the ambassador's neck and starts to choke him, and then Buck comes to the rescue and the ambassador saves himself. Right after that scene, they get attacked by a bunch of spears from the Neanderthals, and they lose the ambassador, and that's when that scene happens, you know, between him and Buck.
Right, yeah, because he goes off.
Because he runs off because he's like, I gotta screw my head back in. That thing loosened it up a little bit, and I need to make sure it works.
Yeah, he pulls out a can of WD-40 and sprays it all along the screw.
So there's that part of the adventure, and then they keep running into these like heads on spears, kind of like Vlad Tempest or Tempis from the Dracula thing. If you look at it from a historical perspective, he used to impale bodies on these huge spears, but in this case, there's just heads attached to the spears. And they keep running into them and trying to stay away. And that blue troll guides them to this thing called the Cave of the Winds. He's like, you need to go there in order to get to the city because there's this quicksand everywhere. And their ship actually gets put in that quicksand. The ship crashes and gets sucked into the quicksand. And while all this is going on, there's all kinds of intrigue on the two ships, you know. Which I kind of enjoyed. There was like a tension, you know. There was like a meal between the two.
Yeah.
That was really well done because it was like a chess game, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reason I laugh, I agree. I liked those scenes as well. But the one thing that was funny is that the dinner that they have, which Asimov has an idea that if they invite them to dinner, it's a pleasant setting and it'll show hospitality and stuff. But by the end of the dinner, things have escalated, and the ambassador's people, I keep calling them because I didn't write down and didn't quite catch what the people were called. I think it starts with a Z or something. But anyway, the ambassador's people are pretty upset and they leave the dinner. But there was another funny delivery of a line because the ambassador or the other guy, he stops before he's leaving and goes, "Oh, and my compliments to the chef. Her dinner was excellent." And then he turns around and storms back out.
Yeah, after he threatens them, they essentially call in three warships and they gather around the searcher, and they're going to blast the searcher if the ambassador doesn't show up to that conference.
Right.
So that's the tension he has like a Vulcan of his own, the guy on the other ship, you know, that brought the ambassador, whatever those people are called. I forget what they're called too. Mm-hmm. He has like his own Vulcan who's like a guy who's really analytical. That's just giving him facts and saying, you know, there's a percentage that they could be turning the tides on us and blackmailing us and giving them information, but not trying to sway him, but give him facts so he can make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
I almost thought he was a bad guy, but he was more like a Vulcan, like just giving factual information.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to see if the episode summary, no, it doesn't say the name of the, Zycarian, maybe?
Zycarian. Yeah, Zycarian.
I think it's Zycarian. So, eventually the group on the planet, they have to traverse this place called the Cave of the Winds, which I kept... It was funny for me watching it because growing up near Niagara Falls, there's one of the attractions at the falls on the American side is a thing called the Cave of the Winds.
Oh, we have a Cave of the Winds here too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In Colorado Springs, there's a Cave of the Winds.
Okay, this is like you take an elevator down, and there's a little pathway that's along the one cliffside that's not near the waterfall itself. It's sort of near one this side little waterfall. But there's you usually go down there, and there, you wear a raincoat. There's a lot of mist and stuff.
Yeah, this one is just, you can hear like a lot of wind, and there's stalactites and stalagmites, you know?
Okay.
It's one of those caves.
But anyways, they're going through this Cave of the Winds is sort of a classic journey through various puzzles, and there's lots of rhyming being done. A lot of it's coming from ODX. He gives them clues in the form of rhymes.
I did like the one though where they ended up in that one part of the cave where there was like no air and they had like these shields that that were around, and Barb was telling me Hawk is doing a really good impression of a mime because he was pushing against the wall, you know.
Yeah. Tom Christopher must have that pantomime down.
Yeah. They were all acting like there was this wall there, and you knew it wasn't there, but they had
Right.
to pretend it was there. And
Yeah.
it was trapping, it was basically sucking the oxygen out. And they had a riddle, and in order to solve the riddle, he had to Dr. Goodfellow had to pretty much hypnotize Wilma so she could see this like lever and release these invisible shields and let them out. And then the other one was kind of more like an Indiana Jones thing because there were snakes everywhere and there was like this huge acid bath that they could fall into. And Buck, the scene lasted a long time where Buck was trying to cross this like on a little plank and rope, and the wind kept blowing him and knocking him over. And then there was a lightsaber battle. I
Yeah,
forget what
there's.
that guy's name was.
I have no idea how you would spell it, but it was something along the lines of either Ezra Harden or Ezra Harden.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But he's sort of the, as it turns out, the arch nemesis of ODX. And part of the reason that ODX wants them to take this path is he's unable to defeat Ezra Harden, and he needs a champion, and he wants Buck to be the one, but he doesn't tell him that outright. He pretty much kind of manipulates them into it, and you never see Ezra Harden full on. He's in the shadows. You see his weapon, which he calls the Sword of Death and the Sword of Hate. He also speaks in rhymes, but I thought that was funny that ODX hates Ezra Harden. He just lets out this stream of insults, one of which was crapulous misanthrope. So I like that one.
Gotta use that one in at work.
Yeah. What are you, some kind of crapulous misanthrope?
Misanthrope.
Get your act together. But yeah, so there's a lot of rhyming going on. Etrigan would be right at home in this cave.
Yeah.
The Ezra Harden says, "The noisy one has met his fate. Come now, Earthling, and feel the weight of Ezra Harden's sword of hate." Speaking to Buck, and the noisy one he's indicating is ODX, when because ODX gets knocked out, gets a wound to his head, which is a bloody wound, and the red really stands out against his blue skin, I must
Yeah.
say. But of course, Buck finally is able to defeat Ezra Harden. It's kind of a weird sequence where the weapon that he's using keeps shattering into a smaller point, and it's like they're trying to figure out a puzzle, but the puzzle ultimately, the solution, at least to me, seemed to be just to stab him.
Yeah.
Stab him with the end of the. They're sort of
Which is
focused on the word pierce, but.
the obvious thing to do, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah.
if you didn't know what to do and there was no riddle, that's probably what you do is you have a spear, you're gonna try to poke him with it.
Exactly.
It's the only thing you can do, because he's like an invisible entity with the lightsaber.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thought that was a little bit weird, but...
And it's kind of cool, though, that the ODX has had a rivalry with this guy forever, and mm-hmm. he uses Buck and crew to try to defeat him. Because he knows he can't, because his power's in his eyesight and he can't see Hazer Houghton or whatever his name is.
Right.
He can't use his eye powers. So he uses Buck to fight him, and he finally conquers that. And he's thrilled. He takes his sword and throws it into the acid bath, and they're done with it. And when they come out of the Cave of the Winds, they're surrounded by Neanderthals. And the one thing that the ambassador notices is they kind of worship these headless sticks with bodies on them, and he takes off his head and pretends he's a god so they can get past him. And yeah. Sure enough, they fall to their knees, and you know, like, they really treat him as a god. And that's the first time that Wilma sees the ambassador without a head or a detached head.
Yeah, she's just staring at him the whole time. Like, what the hell? but this is one of the points that the actor, Mark Lenard, he does. I thought I was impressed with the job that he does of delivering this speech. I thought it was one of the moments where he sold it. Mm-hmm. But he did a pretty good job. And earlier. There ends up being a callback, because earlier at the end of the conversation that Wilma and Buck have about the ambassador, it pretty much ends with Wilma saying, "I think he's quite a man." And in the end, when the group's able to get back to the ship, things resolve fairly quickly, because the other group sees that the ambassador is okay, his people see that he's okay, and so... everything's resolved, and they vow to continue their to repair the relationship between the two species and maintain a better communication and stuff. And as he's walking away, Buck calls back to that line, stating that he's quite a man. So he's at that point impressed with the ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that it definitely continued something we talked about in the first episode of the season, where there was not much campiness and there was not much humor, especially from Buck. I don't think of him really making any jokes this time, and he was very serious throughout most of it.
Yeah, not definitely even smiling. Actually, Hawk had more of a sense of humor than Buck did in this episode.
Yeah, Buck was very serious, and I know that was something that we talked about and that has been said about this season and change in his character, and I definitely saw that continue here.
I notice when Hawk moves, like when he's running, like, because he does a lot of like rock running. He does it pretty impressive, because it does look like real rock. Mm. Or like he's jumping down from rocks and stuff. He doesn't use his arms much. They're like bird arms, you know? His elbows just, like, stick to his side. It's weird.
I can't say I've
noticed
that.
I wonder if that's the actor doing it, though, or if he's purposely trying to portray, like, a bird-like stance or something. It's weird. Next time you look at him running, he seems to run a lot.
Mm-hmm.
His arms don't swing from side to side.
Huh.
And I don't know if it's his armor allows it. I don't know. That little black getup that he wears.
Yeah. Well, so next time we have a single episode story. I think all the rest, yeah, from here on out, it's all single episode stories, it looks like. And it's called The Guardians.
Right.
So...
So this ended in peace, and their relationship may continue in the future, but they separate. the ambassador and Wilma. Wilma says, I'm not ready. I haven't achieved what I want to achieve in life. She kind of implied he was old and he did achieve what he wanted to achieve.
Yeah, they did have a number of conversations throughout the episode. As you say, as they're traveling, they spend a lot of time together. And he acknowledges that he's older, and she tells him, you know, she likes to think of it as him being distinguished, but, and he does want her to settle down with him. And she says, you know, I'm not ready for that. I'm not at that point yet. You know, this is all before she sees that he's got a detachable head.
Yeah.
So who knows how that would influence her. I mean, maybe if she was,
I don't want to have children that have detachable heads.
Yeah.
That could be it.
So, yeah, like you said, I mean, I don't, it isn't terrible. There were definitely things to enjoy about the episode.
Maybe now that they're shorter, we'll see how it goes, because these have been two back-to-back.
Yeah.
Two-parters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't. The changes and a step down in quality from the first season are clear. I think it has lost a number of things that made it unique and stand out from other sci-fi shows of the era.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they were intentionally trying to be more like other shows of the era, and I don't think that was a wise decision, but it isn't terrible.
Yeah.
So
only a few more left. We got 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Well, I guess there's a handful. We got about 12 episodes still.
Yeah.
Or 10 episodes.
Mhm.
It's like 10.
Yeah. I didn't put out a request for questions. I don't know if you did.
No, you know, I didn't.
I did notice that listener Brian Reigate and host of Comics and History watched Taxi Driver due to us covering it on the podcast, and I saw that he posted to Facebook that it was quite an eye opener. So mm-hmm. I just wanted to let him know that it's an because Brian's Canadian, I wanted to let him know that it's an accurate portrayal of life in America and American cities. That pretty much shows you what it's like in American cities. So now you know.
Yeah.
It's all druggies and prostitutes down here. Teenage prostitutes.
Oh, he did send us an email too.
That's true, yep.
And it did have a question in there.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, too.
First, he said that he was listening to your podcast about the Cosmic Treadmill, and he was talking about appreciation for John Broome's writing, and that led to the question he's asking us. Here's a question for you guys to tackle in the future episode. What Silver or Bronze Age writers do you feel should receive greater recognition? And I know which ones are mine. Kerry Bates, for his Superman and Flash. I really love that guy's stuff. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were very weird and bizarre, but I really enjoyed them. And the other one was David Michelinie. He did a lot of Unknown Soldier, and he did do some Aquaman that I read yesterday. Mm-hmm. So, I mostly know David Michelinie from Iron Man and Amazing Spider-Man, because to me, that's like the run, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he also did a lot of stuff for DC, too, that I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know his DC work a lot. And honestly, he's a good choice because he's someone who, at least me and my friends when I was a kid, was overshadowed by the artists that he was working with. I didn't even really, I hate to say it, but I didn't even know his name really when I was a kid.
Yeah, it was all about Todd McFarlane. or Eric Larson, or you know, he had all these great artists drawing for him, but or it was Bob Layton on Iron Man, right? I mean, he was overshadowed by the artists and the people that, you know, they always talk about, like Bob Layton's Iron Man, or you know, or Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man, but he was doing all these plots for these stories. He was creating these characters like Venom and stuff like this. Do you know what I mean? Like his output on the stories, and a lot of the comics back then for Spider-Man at least were bi-monthly. They come out twice monthly.
Right.
It was coming out a lot, and there was a lot of story, and I don't think it would have been as impactful if he didn't write them. Do you know what I mean? The thing that kept our attention was the art, but the story was really good.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at the time, I didn't understand that, but going back as an adult and rereading that era of Amazing Spider-Man really helped me to understand his contribution and appreciate it more. Because, I mean, the only time I've ever had a mail order subscription to a comic book was Amazing Spider-Man when he was writing it and Eric Larson was drawing it. But, I mean, that's typical of my whole experience of collecting comics as a kid. I was so focused on the art, and it was a lot of the artists that at Marvel that would go on to form Image Comics. And I, as an adult, have gone back and understanding how comics are made a lot better, have a greater appreciation for the writers, like David Michelinie. You know, I mean, Chris Claremont obviously is not an underappreciated writer, but you know, I understand his part of the comics that he did with Jim Lee better, and Louise Simonson towards the end there. And I know those names now, whereas when I was a kid, with maybe the exception of Chris Claremont, I didn't really understand it or really pay attention to it, at least.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, John Broome came up because I've been doing the From Kid to Flash podcast, and he is responsible for creating a lot of stuff, but you don't hear his name as much as you do people like Bob Kane and Jerry Siegel and stuff like that. So,
Mike Frederick does a lot of crazy stuff, like with the Phantom Stranger and Spectre and Dr. 13. And I think he's underrated because everything I've read from that stuff, it holds up today. Like the only stuff I read back in the day from him that I remembered was the Spectre. And is because at the time of superhero comics, the Spectre was like killing people, like with crazy ghost-like contraptions. It was basically a story of a bad guy that would do something evil, maybe slit somebody's throat, or he was a barber that would kill people, and he would kill them with scissors, or do you know what I mean? He would kill them in the contraption that made him evil, or he would, if he would like treat people bad and not feed them or something, he would turn him into a mouse and put like mouse traps next to him. Like he would treat people like rodents, so he would be treated like a rodent. He had a really violent run on Spectre, and that's what I remember him from. But there's a whole bunch of Jerry Conway for what he did for everything. Jerry Conway was all over the place in Bronze Age. What he did for Spider-Man and Firestorm, and I mean, everything that he did is amazing. I could go on forever. We could just do an episode on creators.
Yeah, I think, but David Michelinie and Mike Friedrich, those are really good ones, I think, that stand out.
Yeah, and I learned more. Like, when I was young, Bronze Age, I was in the Bronze Age, and I didn't pay attention. A comic was a comic. I didn't pay attention to the creator. So I learn a lot, like when I read Back Issue Magazine or something, like who was writing during these times that I was enjoying the books, because I never paid attention to necessarily. I was paying attention to the character in the story. I didn't right. look at the name of who wrote it or who was responsible. So a lot of times I discover late that I really appreciate somebody I didn't even know about.
True.
All right. Do you want to jump into some comics?
Yeah. Let's do it.
All right. I'll go first this time. And sure. I went to get a long box for another reason. I was trying to find a lot. As Chris knows, I've been delving into 2010, which isn't in our 10-year rule. So I'm not going to be talking about any books in 2010, but that led me to find another box that kind of was my choices for the week. So I ran across an amalgam book, which was DC and Marvel amalgamations. This happened during the time when DC and Marvel were doing the DC versus Marvel books, and it was around 1996. And the one book that I read was called Assassins, written by DJ Chinchester and art by Scott McDaniel. Seen a lot of work from Scott McDaniel. DJ Chinchester, I remember a lot from Daredevil back in the day. I think it was the 90s. And this is an amalgamation of Catwoman and Elektra. Her name's Elektra Kyle. And her name is Cat's Eye. And another character called Dare, who is an amalgamation of Daredevil or Matt Murdock and Deathstroke. So she's we have Elektra, Catwoman in one person, and Deathstroke and Daredevil in another. And which is interesting because blindness plus a patch over one eye. And then the main villain is Enigma Fisk. So it's like a fat kingpin that's constantly throwing out riddles. And they're going after him in a tower. And they have to go through various levels to get to him. And one of the first levels that they get to is an amalgamation of Cheetah and Kraven. The one thing that's very interesting about this story, or that makes it entertaining, it's not the plot. It's the amalgamations. Like, what am I going to see next? Or what Marvel and DC characters are they going to combine, you know? And I found the amalgamations to be pretty good. Like, Cheetah and Kraven, that's a pretty good cross.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So they actually fight Cheetah and Kraven to get through that, and meanwhile Jimmy Urich is reporting on Kingpin, which is very interesting. And it's pretty cool because they have like things that are happening around the universe, like Doctor Strange Fate, which is an amalgamation between Doctor Strange and Doctor Fate. And they Jimmy Urich is, you know, Jimmy Olsen and Urich from Daredevil. So it's like they do like weird stuff like that. And then they do like plays off of the words. Like they'll mention like, man, that thing was like a death stroke. You know, they'll do shit off of the characters' names, which is entertaining. They ran into another amalgamation between Cable and Manhunter, which was a unique looking character. And his name was Nathan Chase. Chase from the Manhunter and Nathan from Cable. So, and then they had to go through him, and then they get to Fisk, and he basically takes out Dare. Dare is the amalgamation between Deathstroke and Daredevil. Her name is Dare, and he pretty much kills her. And Cat's Eye imagines. Takes out Enigma Fisk, and it says to be continued, but I don't think it ever is. I think it's one of those things that is just like to make it look like a regular comic.
Right, gotcha.
Yeah.
Give the impression of a world where the amalgam continued.
Mm-hmm.
I've never read any amalgam comics, but I've browsed them just looking at what the combinations were.
Yeah, I don't think the plots are great, but what's interesting is the amalgamations and seeing the supporting cast and stuff that they create out of this.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. Yeah, so the 2010 boxes you found, I guessed that you had found at least a box of unread 2010 comics because you were posting stuff as you had read it. And after a few different series popped up, I started to notice or realize that they were all from around the same time and guessed that you had found a box.
Yeah, I found two long boxes. And the interesting thing about that is I found, God, I got so immersed in it. Usually I'll just like poke in there, mm-hmm, and like pull out one title out. Mm-hmm. But I really dug deep. I pulled out the entire Rebels and got caught up on that. Warlord, I got caught up on that. I read Jeff Lemire's Superboy. I just got so immersed in that time period, which I thought was amazing. And then I read Warlord, which I thought was like phenomenal. I didn't realize it really, really continued from the original series. Like it was like a bridge to get to like a new state for Warlord. It was brilliant. Mm. But I read a lot of 2010, 2009 comics in the last couple of days.
That's cool.
Oh, Zatanna was the other one.
Right, yeah.
I really got hooked up in that.
Rebels. Did you say that?
Yeah, Rebels.
Milestone
Forever. I finally got caught up in the two-issue arc that Milestone did right before Flashpoint. They were so well done. Oh, man, were they really well done.
That's cool.
Because I had read the whole arc of Hardware and a couple of other titles, and this like paid tribute to all of them. You know, I thought it was a really good tribute addition, and it described everything at a high level that happened in the past, and then got you to the next phase. Like it aged Static, it aged Hardware, it aged these characters and said, well, here's where they are now. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It was really good. I highly recommend it. It's good stuff.
That's cool. Yeah, I know of that. It'd be kind of cool to check that out someday if I ever read more of the original Milestone.
And the other thing I want to point out is Zombie. I read the Zombie, but which is a Milestone character that was relaunched. I read the second arc of it, and it was mind-blowingly good. Like it was so good that I'll always remember it. It's not going to be something I'm going to forget. Mm-hmm. Really, really good story in the realm of magic and fantasy, and good stuff.
Nice. All right, well, I'll start out with another issue of Tomb of Dracula that I read. Just one this time. It is issue 8, continuing from where I left off. And this is, prior to reading any of these, I associated Marv Wolfman with the series. And this is the first one that he actually wrote. I think he writes them all from here on out. But Gene Colan continued on the book as the artist, although interestingly, this issue, it credits him and Ernie Chua as the art. And I have to say that I think that it's more Ernie Chua than Gene Colan. It's I'm assuming that Gene Colan did maybe rough pencils layouts, kind of, because the overall, like, the layouts of the pictures and or of the panels and whatnot sort of seems similar, but there's a lot more, there's a different approach to the faces, and it's not as, Gene Colan sort of gives you, like, uses a lot of shadowing, and there's a lot of, like, there's not as much detail to the faces, or the detail, or the way that the faces are rendered are different than the way they look in this issue, and the overall effect is not as pretty to my eyes as the book normally looks, but I did preview issue 9, and it's back to sort of looking how it the art normally looks. So perhaps Gene Colan just needed to kind of catch up and didn't do as much work on this one. But the story is called The Hell Crawlers, and it pretty much just continues from the end of last issue, where Dracula's been shot by a arrow and poisoned by Quincy Harker, the guy in the wheelchair. And so Dracula quickly escapes and goes to a doctor named Heinrich Mort. And that's Mort, M-O-R-T-T-E. Mort is French for death, of course. And so I think he just added an extra T in there to make it look a little different. But it's interesting when you first see, we join Dr. Mort and his daughter, and they have this clinic. There's a lot of patients and stuff. And it's a little foreshadowing where a doctor is, or where a patient's acting, are you going to have time to see me? And the doctor says, now, are you really so eager to donate your blood? Perhaps I should not complain. Not every doctor has so many willing patients. And then Dracula crashes through the window as a bat and hits the floor and immediately transforms. And while all this is going on, our other heroes, Rachel Van Helsing and Taj and Frank, they're dealing with the children that Dracula possessed last time and set after them. So they escape from the castle that they're in by trapping the children in a room, but it's only just sort of a temporary fix where they get out and get into vehicle, but then the vehicle doesn't start. And so then they're trapped there, and they have to deal with the children get out and start attacking the vehicle and swarming all over it. But it turns out that the doctor himself is a vampire, and it's a secret to his daughter. So the whole thing, he's been subsisting on blood donations from his patients, who must just think that they're donating for medical purposes, and he's actually consuming that blood so that he doesn't have to feed on actual humans. And he's keeping this, his status as a vampire, a secret from his daughter. So Dracula knows all this and uses it to blackmail him, so that into giving him a complete transfusion, a dangerous procedure for a vampire, but necessary because of the poison in Dracula's blood, and pretty much has to use up all the blood that he's been storing for his own use, the doctor, to do this. But so once Dracula's feeling better and stuff, he's not done with Dr. Mort. He has more that he wants from him, and there's this device that the doctor had invented. Not something, again, not something he's proud of, and another secret of his, called The Projector. And Dracula once again blackmails him into using it. It looks like it's funny because it's called a projector, and it looks like one of those, at least back when I was in school, we still used film strip. Like, we watched like film projectors. We'd watch like movies in classes.
8mm films, or the big, except it's bigger than 8mm.
Well, we'd have like, there'd be like two different kinds. One where there's the big wheels of film, and then we had the like the littler machines.
Yeah.
That had the small canisters of film strips that you'd feed into it, and it looks like one of those, one of the smaller ones.
Mm.
But instead of putting children to sleep with boredom, this projector raises the dead. So I guess it does the opposite. once they use it, zombies, well, they look like zombies, but they call them vampires in the issue. But unfortunately for Dr. Mort, as his daughter happens to be at the graveyard at the time, she's visiting their mother's grave. And the secret is out to his daughter, Aunt Adrian, I think her name is. Apparently her mother had been infected as a vampire as well, but she sacrificed herself. So his daughter's taking all this in, doesn't really know what's going on. And then the end of the issue is, as the heroes finally escape from the van, because the children are distracted by this helicopter that shows up. Another one of the team of Quincy Harker's people that they were trying to get through to finally shows up. They have a connection to the House of Lords. It's like a secret member of their group that helps them with gear and stuff. He got her the helicopter, so she's able to appear and scare off the kids just in time. So they're going to head back to the fortress and wait for Dracula to return. It ends up in kind of like a cliffhanger where there's a fight between Dracula as a bat and Dr. Mort as a bat, because Mort he grabs the projector, and it's kind of funny because there's this bat flying with, even though it's a unnaturally large bat, there's this bat flying holding this projector in its claws, and the two of them are fighting over the projector in the sky while down below Dr. Mort's daughter is trying to run away from the zombies. But fortunately the projector falls amidst the fight between the two bats, and when it hits the ground it shatters, and that causes all the zombie like creatures to disintegrate, and Dr. Mort falls from the sky, and as he lands on a fence post with sharp points and turns back into his human self, and it ends with Adrian crying over the body of her father. So the story itself, I definitely still enjoyed it, kind of consistent with the quality of the first seven issues, though the art was definitely fine. It was serviceable in terms of storytelling and stuff, but it lacked a little bit of the beauty of when there's a bit more of Ernie Colon to
Ernie Colon. Gene
Colon.
You mixed the artist as well.
Yeah, more Gene Colon than Ernie Chua.
Yeah.
So yes.
All right. Well, my next book is a different one. It's from Eclipse Comics. It's called The Air Fighters Meet Sergeant Strike. It is from January 1988. It's written by Chuck Dixon. Chuck Dixon did a lot for Eclipse, like in terms of Airboy. Mm-hmm. And art is Tom Lyle. Tom Lyle's a well-known artist as well. But this was a good series. I really liked it because I've been into World War II, and this takes place in happens right before D-Day, and it introduces you to a bunch of characters. This is a one-shot, and what it's very effective in doing is introducing you to many different characters that are fighting the Nazis, and one of them is the Flying Dutchman, and I really like this character because he just seemed like he was he followed nobody's rules, but he was almost like the Joker in a plane, and what he would end up doing is he lost his family and stuff to Nazis, but kind of lost his mind, and he would just go bomb trains and stuff on his plane and just shoot the hell out of them and laugh. He's like an angel of death, and he would just attack and attack and attack, and he would smile as he killed people because I don't think he was all there. I think when he lost his family and his people, he just turned. Anytime he saw a swastika, he knew he had to take them out, and that's what his goal was. And that's the end of that part of the story. Is it introduces you to the Flying Dutchman, and he just kills a bunch of Nazis, and then it cuts to them, these guys, these two Dutchmen, finding plans in one of the trains, just coincidentally, from a Nazi that showed a satellite in a space station, and those plans get back to Sergeant Strike, and he's pretty much a Captain America ripoff, almost exactly like that. He gets these battle plans, and they're pretty much saying you have to go after these Nazis instead of participate in D-Day. He thought he was going to D-Day. Because they're actually building a satellite in space that's going to hurt our capabilities. It's called Thor's Hammer, and he has to go disable it. That's his whole job. And then the scene cuts to Sky Wolf, and he's talking to another biplane fighter called I think her name is what is her name? Oh, Black Angel. Her costume's weird. Sky Wolf he's actually got like a wolf carcass as a head. And Black Angel kind of looks like Black Orchid, if you've ever seen Black Orchid in DC Comics. But he's got a rivalry called Von Tundra, and he needs to go. Instead of planning, the angel tells him, hey, you can't go. That he's basically setting you up. He had a bunch of Nazis invade his house, and he's like, he's basically saying, come get me, and you're going off half-cocked to go after him, knowing you're going to fall into a trap. But he takes the Sky Wolves with him, and they all go to go bomb this place. And Von Tundra has set up a trap for them. So as they come, sure enough, Skywolf falls into the trap, and they take off Skywolf, and they capture him and bring him in to be beaten to death. But what Von Tundra didn't know is that Airboy, who's probably the most known Eclipse character and Golden Age character in comics, he doesn't appear much in this book, but he's there with Valkyrie, and he's talking about he's basically, his mission is to drop off Sergeant Strike, and that's it, and then go have sex with Valkyrie. So he drops off Sergeant Strike, and Sergeant Strike rescues Airwolf, and then they all team up to take out Captain Tundra, and the rest of the Sky Wolves show up, and they assist with this. And then there's a Captain America scene at the end where they launch the rocket into space. and Captain, very much like Captain America, Sergeant Strike jumps on the rocket and takes it out. And you think they think he died in an explosion, but he ends up walking off at the end. But it was a really cool story. I can't believe how much they got into. They had like 10 or 15 characters, and they managed to flesh out all the characters and tell a complete story in 22 pages. Well, actually, it was 27, so.
Still,
add a little bit more. It's still quite effective. I enjoyed it. Yeah, it made me want to read more of these characters, like Airboy and Sergeant Strike and Skywolf and the Wolf Pack.
That's cool. Yeah, it's interesting the different amounts of story that you can experience between the pages of an issue of a comic.
Yeah.
You could get a lot of story or not quite that much.
Yeah, and the decompressed story, it's like you just got one thing accomplished and only one character, and it was all happening in a room. In one room in the decompressed story. And then this one, you had a whole adventure with all these different characters. They managed to introduce all these fighters, you know, that most of these fighter guys are plane guys, which is kind of interesting because you don't see a lot of that. But they actually fly planes, except for Sergeant Strike. He's the Captain America guy, but which was really cool. It was like a Air Force attack. And it was happening on the day before D-Day, and these guys had nothing to do with D-Day. They were doing the side thing, so they didn't launch this thing into space, the satellite into space, which would cause Thor's hammer, which would cause pretty much the Axis to win the war. At least that's what they said, if it was launched into space.
Cool. Let's see. So, I also continued to read Detective Comics. I think the last time we talked about it was a couple issues or a couple episodes ago, but another two-part storyline. I think the last one was a two-parter too about the one about Puppet Master, or Scarface. And that's another two-parter. Issues 585 and 586. And again, this is the Wagner, Grant, Breyfogle team. And this story, maybe you'll know if this character existed before. It deals with the Rat Catcher.
I don't remember if it's his first. What issue is this again?
Detective Comics 585 and 586. 585 has inks by Ricardo Villagran, and 586 is Breyfogle does his own inks. And so 585 starts out with Batman taking out some weapon smugglers, and while that's going on, we see some men that are trapped in some kind of a prison, and one of them manages to, seems like he's been at it for a really long time, he managed to let loose on one of the bars and push it to the side enough that he's able to squeeze himself out, and all these men, they're all really dirty, and they have really long hair, really long beards, and you get the impression that they've probably been imprisoned for a while. So we watch this old man try to make his way out of sewers that these cells turn out to be in sewers, and he's trying to sneak out, but the rats. We see some rats catch up to him, and then we see a man who is dressed in green and red, and he's got a gas mask covering his face, and he blows a little whistle, and that allows him to control the rats. And the rats take off after this old man, catch up to him as he's trying to climb up to a manhole. And it, as this is going on, it's going back and forth with scenes of Batman taking out these weapon smugglers, and he's coming at him pretty brutally. He smashes one guy's hands in the with the trunk of a car as the guy's trying to pull a weapon out of there, and just as Batman is done taking out these guys, the man that's pursued by the rats makes it out of the sewer, and he shows up just as Batman is finishing up with these weapon smugglers. This guy appears just covered in rats from head to toe, and he's screaming, and Batman's trying to get over to him to help him out, but he's dealing with one last guy who's got a rocket launcher of all things. Batman takes that guy out, but by the time he gets over to the old man, the rats have been called away, and the man's body's left behind. His jugular has been ripped out of his throat by the rats. So Batman hears that the sirens of police and fire department on their way, so he leaves all the smugglers that he took out to their attention to see if he can follow the rats that started to sneak away, and he's able to get up on top of a roof and catch sight of this this guy in the gas mask descending back down into the sewers, and so he follows them. The police officers that come on the scene, they look at the body of the old man that's killed by the rats, and they recognize him, or one of them recognizes him as the Honorable Judge Wyatt Hogan, who has been missing for several years. People thought he just disappeared. Down in the sewers, Batman's pursuing the rat catcher. And the rat catcher sets the rats on Batman, who struggles to get off a batarang at the rat catcher while the rats are starting to swarm up his legs and stuff. And the batarang hits a rat instead of the rat catcher, and Batman ends up... he ends up struggling to stay out of the sewer waters and stuff, and he's not really prepared for the fumes and all that, the noxious fumes and the stinky in the sewers, and
the
especially
stinky?
the stinky poo-poos.
That is the first appearance of the rat catcher, by the way. So if he ever appears on Gotham, that book is going to go up at least $10.
Yeah, I'll cross my fingers. Come on.
Yeah.
it sounds like a silly idea, but I think because of the creators involved, they managed to make him like real creepy and just the whole grimy Gotham. This run.
Well, you
continues.
Did the first. You did the last two issues in the last one, right?
Yeah, either last time or the time before, which was the
that was the
Scarface.
First appearance of the ventriloquist.
And the ventriloquist.
Yeah, so that one could be worth some money too. In the future, right now it's not.
No, I was gonna say because I got them pretty recently and they weren't expensive, but
all it takes is a cameo and. One of the movies, and it goes up at least $10-$20.
Yeah. So 585 ends with the rat catcher flooding the tunnels with sewage from the plant. Batman tries to get away in time, but he's hit by the force of the sewer waters coming at a real top speed. It hits him in the back of the neck, and he smacks his head off against the wall of the sewers, and we just see a panel of him floating upside down in sewer water. One final note about this issue. I thought it was interesting, you know, people, the way that they react to Superman and Wonder Woman right now, that the one of the last pages is an advertisement for Action Comics number 600, and it's most of the ad is a big image of Superman and Wonder Woman kissing. And then there's the ad for Checkmate, the Paul Kupperberg series. There's a new team playing the world's deadliest game. The free poster offer. Subscribe to Checkmate and get a beautiful four-color poster for free. $15 for 14 issues. So, really cool Norm Breyfogle cover to 586 with Batman in the foreground, all tattered and lying in some sewer water. And then you just have the rat catcher half in shadows and just all these little tiny eyes to indicate his rats. It's a really cool cover. And so Batman is in a bad position as we ended last time. And then we go back to the cells where there's still a couple old men trapped, and they're excited because they hear someone coming and they're hoping that it's the judge come back because he promised to come get him if he got free. But they're they fall into despair when they see it's just the rat catcher returning. And then in the morgue, we see Commissioner Gordon has been called because they identified the corpse as the judge who's been missing. And they tell Gordon, you know, not to touch him because he's all infested with lice and fleas, and there's fungus growing on his clothes. And like, what the hell happened to this guy? And he's told that they was covered head to toe and rats, and there's a trail of blood leading back to the manhole. And like, it seems like Hogan's been living down there. And from what Gordon knows of Hogan, he calls him High and Mighty Hogan. There's no way that he would have been voluntarily living in filth. And he goes and shines the bat signal, but to no avail, because we see in that Batman is just lying on some steps in the sewer, still completely knocked out. He finally wakes up, and it's kind of neat because they really drive home the environment. This is Batman wakes up. There's just this nauseating stench, and he immediately throws up. Long after his stomach is empty, the spasms continue, and only then does his mind begin to function, take in his surroundings, and remember. So it's pretty nasty down there, they're trying to tell you. And the rat catcher, he, as much as he makes use of the rats, he's not affectionate towards them because he feeds his prisoners rats. And these prisoners, they must have been down here a long time. Well, we know at least like 5 years because they're pretty used to eating rats at this point. They're even upset that they're only giving them one. And they chomp into them pretty enthusiastically. It's kind of nasty. But so Batman, he finds some equipment that was left down there for tunnel repairs. And wraps a stick in some cloth and gas, and is able to create a torch with some gasoline that they had down there for a compressor. And as some police officers are coming down in the sewer to try to investigate what's going on, they have a guide with them that works for the sanitation department. And he's like, oh, don't worry, you know, the rats are scavengers. They're only going to attack when they are cornered. And famous last words, a rat goes flying and bites into the side of his face. And like, they're going crazy. Get them off of me. Use your guns. So they're firing and killing rats, and the rat catcher goes back, and he's going to start executing his prisoners, and he does actually kill one of them, a guy who is blind, and the whole time he's just been saying, I just said what my eyes saw, I just said what my eyes saw, giving you the impression that maybe he was just a witness to whatever went on. Batman's, meanwhile, using this his torch to set rats on fire and stuff. But one of the things that's kind of fun about the rat catcher is he's got this catchphrase where he gives you the impression that he used to work for the sanitation department, because he always says, by the power invested in me by Gotham City Sanitation Department. And that's the power which he invokes to sentence this man, Cornelius Budd, to death, much to the fright of the other prisoners. So back in Commissioner Gordon's office, one of the police officers done research, and they pretty much have figured out who most of the other, who the rat catcher is, and most of the other prisoners are. There's this guy, Flanagan, who had been released from the state pen about 5 years ago, just prior to when Judge Hogan's disappeared. And then there's one of the warders from the prison, Stanley Connick, disappeared. And then the arresting officer, Sam Bellow, and Cornelius Budd, who we just saw killed, was the star witness of the prosecution, because Flanagan had was up for murder. So we have some dialogue between the arresting officer, prisoner, and Flanagan, the rat catcher, where Flanagan tells his justification that for executing them, and he's about to execute the sergeant when Batman shows up, and Batman confronts the rat catcher, and the rat catcher starts blowing on his whistle, try to summon his rats, but Batman says, save your breath, your boys have had their last meal, and you've taken your last prisoner. Spakow! Punches him in the face, shatters the glasses on his gas mask, not pulling his punch there. And there's a fun panel where the police officers are standing around with Commissioner Gordon around a manhole, and they're like, we're going to have to pump gas in there. There's the only way. It's not safe to go down there. And Gordon's refusing. It's not a chance while there's, while Flanagan's prisoners are still down there. And they hear somebody coming, so they all, so they aim their rifles at the manhole, and there's a panel where Batman's head pops up out of the manhole, and he's sort of winking a little bit, says, evening, Jim. And he hauls the prisoners out, and followed by the rat catcher. And the rat catcher, we see him without his mask for the first time, and it's, we don't really see a close-up on his face, but it almost looks like Bray Fogle intended him to have buck teeth in the front. Like, he looks a little bit like a rat himself, just a fun touch. And the story ends with Batman saying that he's got to head to the clinic to get Leslie to treat his wound, because he has a wound in his head that he's afraid is infected now because of the sewage. But yeah, another really cool, just two-part story, real smooth storytelling, and just a real Gotham itself just seems like a real grimy, the whole thing takes place in the sewers and dealing with rats, and just got like a, just has a sort of dark feel to it with still being a superhero comic.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Those years. I mean, just think about back to back two villains created.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just a couple issues.
Yeah, one of them,
which I think is pretty popular, which is Ventriloquist.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought he'd been around longer than that.
Yeah.
So yeah, good stuff.
So I'm going to summarize a couple of issues because my intent was to read one of them, but I couldn't put it down. So I read everything to the end. So I read Aquaman 58 through 63, which is the ending of the first series. It's an interesting series in the fact that it came back. So the first series ran from 1962 to 1971, and then it went to Adventure Comics eventually, mm-hmm. and then Adventure Comics came back to this solo series right after Aquaman's son's death. So once you get the death of the child, this is where it takes off afterwards. It's the ramifications afterwards. And this was traded, but the interesting thing is I hear that the trade doesn't have the backup features that were done by Paul Cooperberg and Juan Ortiz, which is the Mera backup. And there's, I think they're so important to the storyline that I don't know how you could not have it. This is a interesting story arc because Black Manta – The issues that I'm covering does not cover that, but Black Manta killed Arthur Jr., at least so we think. And Arthur goes out on vengeance and ends up running into a bunch of different villains that he has to fight in this, which is kind of weird because he leaves his wife behind with the dead child. And what you learn is that Vulko, the child's not totally dead. The child can be saved. But Mera has to go back to where she came from, which is the other dimension, to get a healing ray that Zybul, you probably heard that name before in Aquaman mythology, but Zybul's a scientist that has this healing ray that she has to go back to her dimension, her hard water dimension, to go get. And there's an adventure there where she fights somebody that took over there and captured Zybul, and she manages to defeat him. His name, let me get what his name is. I've never heard his name before. I've heard of Zybul before. His name was LeRon. Not LeBron James, but LeRon. She had to take him out to save her son's life and get the healing ray, but LeRon had thrown the healing ray into this pit where she had to go get it from, and she had to fight a bunch of elementals and all kinds of other stuff. The sad part is most of the emotion is in the Mera story arcs because she is so frustrated with Arthur. She's like, how could he leave me when we could save our son? And Arthur's out there not knowing that he can save his son, going after the fisherman. And then he goes after the scavenger, and he ends up in this big old crossover with the Justice League with Cobra. And he ends up a lot of different villains coming about before he gets back to Atlantis. And during this time is Aqualad's off on his own adventure trying to figure out who his parents are. Mera is disgusted with Arthur, doesn't want anything to do with him. And he's off just in an angry state. Like, I lost my son. I just want to kill everybody. But it's fascinating because she does bring the healing ray, and it's heartbreaking because she gets there. And Vulko says, your son's dead. You didn't make it in time. So she actually went through all these adventures to get the healing ray. And it's too late. So when Aquaman gets back to Atlantis, she is pissed off at him, like really bad. They're actually at the funeral for the child. And she actually wants him not to be there. like get the fuck away from me. You don't, you can come see your child later. So they're having the funeral for the child. They want him out. And they're getting attacked. Atlantis is getting attacked by this like android thing that's causing this earthquakes at the same time, like roughly the same time the funeral's going on. And these robots manage to capture Arthur and are going to kill him. And it turns out to be his brother, Ocean Master. So just in the course of like 6 to 7 issues, maybe 8 issues, including the one where they kill Arthur's son, you have Black Manta, the Fisherman, the Scavenger, Ocean Master, and Cobra that he has to deal with. Jeez. So, and he does have one issue where he's in, he's fighting Cobra with Batman and the rest of the Justice League, mostly Green Lantern, Batman, and himself. So I really liked it. The story, you know, we just talked about it. It was primarily Aquaman story was the David Michelinie. The Mara story was the Paul Cooperberg. That's the one I preferred, is the Mara story, because I felt like there was more. It was more heartfelt, because if you lose your son, her reaction was like a bear, you know, a mother bear protecting her cub, and then her cub is dead, and she's like, I'm just gonna do whatever I have to try to get my cub back, you know. And Arthur's story was a little less, he was a little more detached, and that could be a legitimate male reaction if you lose your son. I don't know. I just read Warlord, Warlord, the original Warlord series, he lost his son. He actually killed his son. Deimos made him kill his son, or think he killed his son. But in the revamp of the series, you find out that he killed a clone of his son, and that his son was alive all the time. And his name was Tinder. And Deimos comes back and makes the son kill the father. So it's like a beautiful, I don't know how to say it. It's like a, you've come full circle. And this Aquaman series is dark. But it doesn't seem as dark as the Mara story arc, which is kind of touching and depressing. And I am shocked that Donnie, me and Donnie were talking on Facebook, and he said that it didn't have the Mara story. And I don't know how you could not include that, because it's so much part of that story arc.
Yeah, that's weird. And not only just important to the character. You know.
I hope it's there and he just doesn't see it. You know, like,
maybe
they make it seamless instead of like, here's your first story and here's your backup.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, in the trade, maybe it just blends in and it looks the same. Mm-hmm. But that'll not be good if they. But this is a good arc. I'd recommend it. I'd recommend even reading the trade. Hopefully, they have the Mara stuff in there. But the art started off like super, and even though Don Newton draws a good Aquaman, Don Newton reminded me of Alan Davis. His art style kind of looks like Alan Davis, at least to me. Okay, some people might say, "Fuck you, Mike. That's not Alan Davis." But Don Newton looked like Alan Davis to me, but I didn't like it because Jim Aparo did the first few, and that was like fantastic to me. Like I love Jim Aparo, so seeing Jim Aparo on Aquaman was like, hey, this is great. And then they jumped to Don Newton, who's a very good artist, but it wasn't Jim Aparo. So it was kind of like your situation where you had two good artists, I think, you know, but you were used to one style, and then all of a sudden the style changed.
Yeah.
And even though that style looked good, it was a little more jarring to you, and you wanted the old style back, you know?
Yeah, and almost in Tomb of Dracula's case, I think I almost mixed up the names again. Gene Colan, his style is so, it fits that, fits horror so well, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It looks so good that,
And the other thing I just want to point out before I hand the reins over to you is Aquaman letters pages were very interesting to read in this time period because they were printing letters pages from Adventure Comics, which at this time was like Aquaman Plastic Man or Aquaman and Starman. I don't remember, but it was Aquaman was in a dual book. It was a shared book. And man, the fans didn't like that book. it was kind of interesting because it was like reading people bitch and complain about Aquaman, you know, that on Facebook now because there's an actor in an outfit that doesn't look like their Aquaman.
Yeah, so
it was interesting to read those art articles to say there's complainers going back to the 70s.
Yeah.
That just won't let shit go, you know?
Yeah. Not as much has changed as we think sometimes. It's just more immediate.
It's just more accessible. Yeah, it's just more in your face.
That's something that I was listening this week a lot to episodes of a podcast called Great Expectations. It's an X-Men podcast. And I initially checked it out because Alan White has appeared on a couple episodes. So I listened to the first episode that he was on, and then I've been listening to some more episodes of it. And they've talked about that a number of times because one of the hosts, Sean, most of the time he's reading from individual issues that he has in his collection, and then I guess the Uncanny X-Men omnibus reprints the letter columns also, which is what the other host is reading it from, which that's cool because a lot of times they don't do that, but they've at times read some of the letters or talked about some of the things that people put in the letters, including there was an amusing one by Kurt Busiek, which just like totally tore apart the Dark Phoenix saga and how bad it was, which is pretty funny.
That is funny because that's a creator,
right? Yeah,
it's like you guys, this is awful.
Tearing apart,
a well thought of story.
Well thought of is one of maybe the best comic stories of all time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amusing, but they've other times talked about just, you know, people back in the letter writing days, just writing in, you know, and complaining.
Yeah. I got hooked on the story though. Like I didn't have any intent to finish it. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm going to read, I found three of the issues and I said, okay, I'll read this one, okay? I read it, and then I'll save the next one for next week or whenever, because I only had three of them that I bought, and I became so engrossed in the story that I didn't have the next three, but I went to Comixology immediately and said, "Oh, thank God, they have the next three," because I was like. Nice. I'm going to have to order this on my comic shop or get these comics because I want to know what happens. And the interesting thing about is the next few issues, it wasn't two stories. So the Maris, I had the issues that had the Maris story, which is the part that I really wanted to flesh out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is Aqualad comes back into Aquaman's life at the end of the story. And he says, "How's Arthur Jr.?" It's like awkward, you know. So he's right. Dead, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, he has a big. The climax of the story is he has a big battle with his brother, who hates him, Ocean Master. But yeah, I kind of love it when that happens. It's like I have to go. Find the story. The same thing as happened with those 2010 comics as I was reading Zatanna, and they introduced Paul Dini introduced this Brother Knight storyline in that, and I wanted to finish it, And I was missing the next issue, so I went to Comixology and I downloaded it, and I realized that this isn't the continuation of the Brother Knight story. It was a standalone issue. So then I said, I have two more issues for them to finish this Brother Knight story, and they didn't even finish it. It just ended because Flashpoint came in the end. It was the end.
Oh man.
So they never, they had this like open it, Paul Dini had this open-ended thread with that kind of ended on a cliffhanger, and then it was never resolved.
Yeah.
Unless somebody knows out there that it's resolved in some other book, but I kind of did my research. I went and Googled Brother Knight to try to figure out if it was concluded anywhere, and it wasn't mentioned. I couldn't find it. But yeah, there's some that one thing I do love about Comixology is if you run into a situation where you missed an issue and you're like, damn it, you at least have a chance to go find it. And that's on demand. In other words, I don't have to wait 3 days right. or a week to get the book shipped to me. I could go read it right now.
Yeah. Definitely. Instant gratification.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just have one more. Speaking of ordering online, I had a few orders that I did lately, a back issue. So it's kind of for the first time in a while, I picked up some stuff that I'll to eventually cover on from Kid to Flash and a few other things, just kind of round out the orders to hit like a free shipping threshold and stuff. And one of those that I just kind of picked up just to read and for no other reason is this issue, which is DC Comics Presents 86. We didn't cover, but we talked in passing at one point, I remember, about the issue that follows this one, which is a team up with Superboy, where it really kind of ties into with Superboy Prime, rather, where it really ties into Crisis. This is also a Crisis crossover issue, and it's Superman and Supergirl.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out right around the same time where, spoilers, the Crisis issue where Supergirl dies. Maybe even the same day, I'm not sure, but definitely.
You just spoiled Crisis for Infinite Earths on me. Come on.
Yeah. Says host of DC Noise. Here's another spoiler for Crisis on Infinite Earths. The heroes essentially lose.
Barry dies.
Barry dies, yep. But that second spoiler there is interesting to know in the backdrop of this issue, because this really is kind of like a goodbye issue to the pre-Crisis Supergirl. It is called Into the Valley of the Shadow, and it's written by Paul Kupperberg with art by Rick Hoberg, inks by Dave Hunt. So it definitely does tie into Crisis. Some Crisis issues tied in more than others, crossover issues. And 'cause the first page talks about how the universe is going mad, and there are two black holes within proximity of each other. And then we go into Chicago, where Supergirl deals with some hoodlums that are taking advantage of the panic that's going on. A lot of people all throughout Metropolis and Chicago and Gotham and stuff we see throughout the issue are staying indoors because the skies are going crazy, and these hoods are taking advantage of it, trying to do some looting. And so she takes care of them. And then over in Metropolis, Superman, Clark Kent's in working, and he sees with his supervision that this double black hole configuration in the sky. So he excuses himself and goes off to check it out as Superman. There's kind of this neat little sequence where Supergirl is in her apartment in Chicago as Linda Danvers, and she gets a phone call from Barbara Gordon in Gotham, wants to chat with her. It's just kind of just neat to see the two female characters interacting, and they really, it's just like a character moment, because Barbara, they meet up in Gotham City in costume, and Barbara is just trying to deal with the fact that Gotham is so empty and everyone's staying inside and awaiting the end times. And she's like, you know, I've faced death so often because I never truly believed I would die, but now I'm so very, very scared. I don't think I was ever cut out for playing hero. And Supergirl reassures her that there's thousands of people out there without powers that are just trying to help their, do their best, like policemen, firemen, just trying to hold the world together. And Barbara's inspired by Supergirl's selflessness, and Supergirl's thoughts are interesting. She's just reflecting on the way that even Superman was sent away from Krypton as a child and doesn't remember, but she experienced Krypton crumbling around her firsthand. So what's going on in the crisis reminds her of Krypton, what would happen to Krypton. So really just sort of a character moment there. Barbara doesn't play a role in the rest of the story. A Superman and Supergirl catch up to each other because they're both heading toward the other to find the other, and they end up meeting halfway in the skies. So they're, what's interesting about this issue is that they end up thinking that this black hole configuration, which really is just a symptom of the crisis, they're thinking maybe that's what's causing all this. And they pull in this former villain of named Black Star, and it's a former villain of Supergirl's that she had dealt with in a previous issue, specifically Supergirl 13, 14, and 15, where this woman named Rachel Berkowitz was the daughter of Linda Danvers' landlady. And Rachel and her mother were separated in Poland during World War II, and they went to different concentration camps. Rachel survived and made her way to America, where she was a very brilliant person. She got a bunch of PhDs, and she unlocked the secret to what Einstein called the unified field theory, and it gave her understanding of the whole universe and control over aspects of the cosmos. And to defeat her, Supergirl maneuvered Black Star in between twin black holes, just like the ones that are in the sky now. So Supergirl's thinking maybe she's partly to blame with what happened, because there's two black holes again and Black Star's there, and both her and Superman think, okay, this is what is the cause of all these problems. What's actually the crisis, they think Black Star is to blame. And they think throughout this issue, if they just take care of her, then they'll solve the problem, what's going on. And so for several pages, they battle Black Star. It all takes place in outer space on a really kind of a large scale. And then it comes to a point where Supergirl and Superman are in conflict with each other, because Supergirl wants Superman to leave, to go to a different dimension. So because Black Star actually thinks that Superman is the problem, that she feels that she's in tune with the universe, and she feels that Superman's presence is causing the universe to deconstruct. So Supergirl says, you know, well, I will tell Superman to leave this dimension to prove to you that him leaving is not solving the problems that are going on. But interestingly, Superman refuses. He feels that Supergirl doesn't know what she's doing. He doesn't buy the explanation and that it's not going to work. So he ignores Supergirl and goes after Black Star and attacks her. Supergirl threatens Superman. It's like, you're staying put. You're going to listen to me even if they have to pound it into you. Crack. And she smacks him in the jaw. And Superman pretty much says straight up, listen, I've been at this a lot longer than you. I know how a foe will try to use you. And I can't place the fate of the entire universe on your hunch. And he blasts her with this heat vision. No permanent damage, he says, but hurts her. And so interesting, they're not on the same page with that. And Superman goes after Black Star again, but Supergirl comes up behind him and hits Superman at high speed, knocks him into an alternate reality. It's just a strange psychedelic kind of alternate reality that that is related to Black Star somehow. And Black Star pretty much that believes that this alternate reality is one in which once you enter it and are affected by it, you can't ever leave. But the super duo, the momentums which they Supergirl tackled Superman carries them right through the dimension, and they appear behind Black Star. Black Star is shocked by this, that they really, the distance they traveled through that dimension, they essentially, in the past, it would have taken thousands of light years. And Superman points out additionally that there's a star going nova nearby called Turkron Gila the Sixth. And it was million years of light years away. Superman just passed it last week. It's nice that to be able to just kind of like, oh yeah, I was out near that star that million last week. That's millions of light years away. And it was fine. But
looked normal to me. I just yeah. used my vision and it was okay.
I was just over there at that star that's millions of years last week between lunch and dinner. He said, but he points out, like, even if that star exploded right after I saw it, it still would have taken the light from the explosion millions of years to be seen from here. So there's no way, and clearly we can see it. You know, the only explanation is that the universe has shrunk, and so Black Star starts freaking out the way that she's in tune with the universe. It's like, we have to reestablish the boundaries of the universe. So at this point, basically, Supergirl and Superman end up teaming up with Black Star, and she says, you know, I'm going to use every bit of my power to reverse the gravitational flow of the entire cosmos and push space back to where it's supposed to be. But Superman hits a limit where he's meant to keep going, but he gets pushed back by an irresistible force. They think that they were somewhat successful, but and they're going to try to imprison Black Star again because she's still dangerous, but she disappears, just vanishes, even though Supergirl was keeping an eye on her. It ends on an ominous note where Supergirl says, not a whole lot's been solved either. Everything's as screwy as it was before. And Superman says, and it's back to square one. Do you want to go back to Clark's place and discuss it? And Supergirl says, no thanks, I can't sit still just now. I still feel edgy. Can't shake this ominous feeling. And she's mentioned having an ominous feeling throughout the issue. And there's a little blurb at the end that says, the reason behind Supergirl's morbid feeling becomes deathly clear in the October Crisis on Infinite Earths. So they kind of spell it out right there for you. But
she knew she was going to die.
Yeah, so it's a neat tie-in to Crisis. It's a nice little, and I think it's interesting how the reason I mentioned, you know, essentially when you talk about Crisis and what the heroes wanted to do and what their goals were, they ultimately lose. And I thought it was interesting how this issue essentially is akin to that, where the super duo, they are mistaken about the cause of the universe problems, and they don't really defeat Black Star. She gets away from them, and it ends with all the universe problems. It becomes clear to them that she wasn't responsible in the first place for the problems with the universe, and it's much bigger than that, and it ends on a down note that leads into Supergirl dying. So
a lot of death in these comics.
Yeah. That's a bummer.
One of them was a baby. Come on, man.
Jeez.
I guess they did the same thing in Fantastic Four, though. Because they lost their child when it was being born, you know. Mm-hmm. Valeria the first time.
Mm.
Valeria.
Yeah. While I was talking, I had our silent co-host, my cat, joined us.
Ah.
He's now in my lap, in between my stomach and the laptop.
Nice.
Yeah, he just butts his way in.
I'm cold. I just want some human warmth.
Yeah, that's pretty much how he spends the winter, is on my lap whenever he has the opportunity.
Uh-huh.
Because he doesn't like being cold either.
Right. All righty. Well, this wraps up the Retrocast.
Episode 49.
49. We're almost at 50. What are we going to do for 50? I don't know.
We're going to have to start brainstorming that. Yeah. I will detach my penis.
I'll keep mine attached.
Live on air. Tune in to hear me scream.
Yeah.
Humans
won't like that.
No.
They won't understand.
They won't understand, but
how valuable it is to detach your penis.
Exactly, and they don't get that. I find it really weird that humans can't remove their penises. I find it disgusting that it can't come off.
Yeah. All
right.
But
if you want to talk to us about penises.
Yeah, you could send us email at mythmakingetc@gmail.com or mike@comicbooknoise.com. And we have our website is geekbrunchpodcast.com. That's where you'll see all the episodes. We also post those episodes on the Geek Brunch Podcast Facebook page. And we're on Twitter's at MythMakingETC and at Mike Myers Brunch. And I think that's about it. Did I miss anything?
I don't think so. If you did, that's good enough anyways, right?
Yeah,
it's enough options.
Yeah, you can contact us so many different ways. And thanks, Brian, for the email. I appreciate it. I'm glad we inspired you to go watch What America's Like.
Yeah, now you know. That's not safe down here.
And check out Comics and History. And what else? Anything else?
Yeah, I've been learning about Canadian comics from that podcast.
Yeah.
I didn't even know there was such a thing. I hate to say it, but I was very ignorant of Canadian comics. But he's done some cool episodes about Canadian comics and superheroes, Canadian
Canuck
superheroes.
And the other one, the Golden Age one, right? I can't remember. I haven't listened to the latest, which just came out Monday. But I am going to listen to it.
Yeah,
but both of them
very
I knew nothing about. I didn't Captain Canuck or this one. I didn't know anything.
No, but it's very interesting. It would be cool if they bring this other. I'm looking it up right now. This other, the Golden Age character. It'd be cool, Nelvana of the Northern Lights.
Yeah,
she sounded really cool, and I think the concept sounds really interesting. I think if somebody did a modern version of it, it'd be really cool. So there's a new Captain Canuck comic, so maybe they'll be able to bring Nelvana into that. That'd be cool.
Yep. All right. Well, I'm gonna start eating. And we'll see you guys next time. Take care, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I have to go find the hang-up button now. Harley, don't eat my sandwich.
Harley, Quinn.
Stay. All right, bye.
Bye-bye.